You're listening to Wired for Impact. This is episode number 18 with Tom Satterley. Welcome to Wired for Impact, the home to creators, entrepreneurs, and leaders who are wired to make a difference. My name is Peter King. I'm the host of the program, and in each episode, I bring you world-class leaders to help you get out of your own way, to inspire you to create a compelling vision, and to help you fuel and define a purpose that creates and amplifies your impact. My guest this episode is Delta Force veteran Tom Satterley. This is a conversation that I recorded several years ago, and I wanted to bring it back in the light in lieu of everything that's happened in Afghanistan recently. During this episode, Tom shares very vulnerably several accounts of the battle at Mogadishu, which is what inspired the movie Black Hawk Down, and he holds nothing back. There is some very graphic things that he describes in this conversation. So for those of you who are sensitive to that and or might be triggered by suicidal ideation or just graphic battle scenes, please take note and proceed with caution or not listen to it at all. I also wanted to share that Tom is someone that wrote the book All Secure. He started a foundation called All Secure as well that helps veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a nonprofit. I highly recommend that you support that. Tom and his wife, Jen, have done an incredible job of supporting our veterans when there really wasn't any other help, any other option for them to go to. And they've done a tremendous job supporting them, training them, helping them mitigate the horrors that PTSD can bring back from such dramatic and traumatic warfare. So please check that out. I want to also note that Tom is the recipient of 6 Bronze Stars, 3 with Valor, and served in the Army Delta Force for approximately 20 years and was in the Army for 25 years. So with that, it is my deep honor to share this conversation with you. Here I am with Tom Satterley. All right. We are recording. Tom Satterley, thank you very much for joining the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
It's kind of nice. This is my first in-person live podcast as opposed to doing it over the internet.
So oh, cool.
I was scrambling a little bit to find the right mic and stuff. So hopefully the setting's okay for you. But so as I was doing some research in your story and watching the videos that you had out there and things like that, I was just, I mean, it's some heavy stuff. And I'm for those who are listening right now, can you sort of give them a brief overview of who you are, what your story is, and we can start to get into some of that in a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, Tom Satterley, was born in 1967 in Columbus or at Seymour, Indiana, and grew up basically in small town Indiana. Middle class family, you know, not broke, but my parents didn't buy me anything. So, you know, I had to mow lawns at an early age just to buy myself a bike or anything else I wanted. My parents were always working or always going to school. So pretty much left alone to my own devices. You know, I have an older sister, middle aged brother, and I'm the youngest. Had no idea what I was going to do with my life. Just like any other kid growing up.
Yeah.
And, definitely not the military. Wasn't in my mind.
Really?
I didn't know what it was, but I know my brother joined. He's 2 years older than me. My sister's 4 years older than me. My brother joined the military when he was a junior in high school. So he went to basic training in the summer between junior and senior year.
Okay.
So I'm a sophomore. He's a senior now, and I'm making fun of him for joining the military. just dogging him out, you know. Of course, he beat me up for it, but I had no idea what the military was. I just knew to make fun of it. Nobody in my immediate family had been in the military.
Huh.
I think my dad's brothers were in Vietnam, and my grandparents, you know, were in the war and joined the military for years at a time, but never crossed my mind. And then one of my best friends joined the military after high school, and I was building houses and still thinking about going to Indiana University, trying to save some money. My parents had money that I'd blown, you know, for college. and he came home from basic and AIT, getting to go to Germany, and there was a John Cougar concert up in Indianapolis. And so we were driving up there together. He's telling me all about basic and AIT and going to Germany and how great it was. You know, he was indoctrinated for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, talking about how great basic was.
Yeah, he was at a sales pitch all the way up to Indianapolis for that hour and a half drive. And by the time I got to Indianapolis, I had just kind of decided I was going to join the military.
Huh.
So we went to a recruiter office up there because we got there way early. And instead of sitting around drinking and doing, you know, whatever, went to the recruiter's office, talked to them. And I'm like, well, my mom's, you know, studying to be a doctor. I think I'll be in the medical field. I'll try that. And, of course, he pushes me towards his quota, which at the time was a combat engineer. You know, well, you like to blow stuff up and you do build stuff, so you get to do both. I'm like, well, that sounds really cool, you know. So I signed up that night for the Army, and nobody knew. You know, went to the concert, went home, told my parents the next morning, and they about passed out.
Right, but, I can imagine.
I was old enough to do it on my own, so it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And like, what about college? What about, you know, the construction company you work for? The guy wanted me to take over his company, even though I was just starting. Hmm. You know, he had older guys, contractors and things. So I had a little bit more intelligence, a little bit more know about the construction because I took it in high school as well.
Yeah.
And I told him, and everybody was kind of let down. I felt a little depressed about it, but you know, that was the fall of 85, and okay. I didn't leave till February 86 for Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. So I came straight here to Missouri, unknowing that I'd ever be here again, and did OSIT, which is one station unit training where you do basic and AIT at the same place.
Okay.
Instead of basic and they ship you off somewhere else, I did it all right there at Fort Leonard Wood.
How long was that?
That's about 3 months.
Okay.
It's about 3 months long. And so in June, I got sent off to Germany for my first duty station. And that was a two-year assignment. But I ended up getting married in between AIT and leaving for Germany when I was on leave for 30 days. And so that changed it to a three-year assignment. So I go to Germany. I'm in a combat engineer mechanized unit in Wielflecken, Germany. And the wall's still up. So our major job at the time was to... When the Russians were coming through the Fulda Gap, the horde of Russians that, you know, taking over Western Germany from Eastern Germany, my unit's job was to basically pre-position. We had pre-positioned explosive charges about 3 feet across, wow, about 6 inches thick, called cheese charges. You would lower them into manhole covers in the roads and then prime them and blow the roads to slow the Russians down.
Wow.
Along with their bridges were pre-built.
Wait, so this was... What year was this? This
86.
Was late 80s? Okay, or mid-80s? Okay.
Yeah.
And so what were the Russians doing there at that time?
They were all in East Germany, and everyone was afraid the Russians were going to push through, take over Germany, Western Germany.
Okay.
And they only had basically one way to go. It was the Fulda Gap, near Fulda, Germany. But the mountains and everything, they had this huge gap where all their armor could come through.
Mm-hmm.
So our job was to blow all the roads and all the bridges to slow them down for the
wow.
units in the United States to have time to load up and come over and defend and you gotcha. Know, push them back. So that's all we did was practice for that, blowing up bridges and roads all the time. And a lot of the platoon sergeants at the time were Vietnam vets, and they were kind of burnt out and tired, and I get it now. You know, back in the day, I thought, what's wrong with these old guys? You
yeah.
know, they don't want to do anything.
Yeah.
But they had done their stuff, and they were kind of tired. But we had my platoon sergeant was a former Hungarian sergeant, and he had done a bunch of other things. He was more familiar with Europe and different training through different armies, the German army, the French army. So he took us as the first full platoon to go through French commando school in Neufbrisach, Germany, down in the Black Forest area.
Okay.
And so went through a month-long course as a platoon down there to where we learned.
Through the French's?
French ran it. And
oh, wow. That's interesting.
It was, the barracks were on the German side. It was kind of right on the border in the wine land of Germany. So you got the river down there, the Rhine River, and all the beautiful wine country. And we did training on both sides. And we went through E&E training where they took all your clothes away and gave you like these potato sack pants and gave you your boots back with no shoestrings in them and a brown t-shirt. Lots of cool, you know, unconventional warfare type stuff. Like if a tank's coming rolling up on you, how to roll underneath the tank and then put a sticky bomb on it and roll back out. You know, it was weird
Saving
stuff.
Private Ryan.
Lots of obstacles. So, exactly. Yeah. You know, they're still living in that area. But lots of obstacle courses and... long hikes to the Black Forest, carrying all your gear, which was horrible. But it was fun.
Right.
It was fun. So then he took us to the Swiss March. It was like a 40-mile hike a day in the Swiss Alps
Oof.
For like 5 days. We went down there for three of those 5 days.
40 miles a day?
Yeah.
In all, with all your gear?
Of course. Yeah, we took all our gear. Everybody else is kind of hiking and drinking beer along the way. We're hiking for real. And in the end, we stayed in Bern, Switzerland. All their cities in Switzerland are built up like little, you know, they don't really have a military. But they all have guns and they all have like leadership in blocks of the city mm-hmm. and who's in charge and if there's a war, what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's bunkers built up underneath. So we stayed in those bunkers, those fallout shelters.
Mm.
And it's basically like this table. If this is one shelf of bunks in a hole in the ground, you know, there's like seven layers of this, and there'd be 20 people laid out just sleeping next to each other, you know, and people are coming in drunk and falling asleep. I'm already asleep because we're waiting for the next day to do good, you know. People just climbing up next to you and falling asleep. So all those different experiences. And then they had a slot open up for German Ranger School. And you had to, they were going to send an officer from the headquarters battalion. And I kind of spoke up. I said, why don't you run a competition and send the best guy, you know, send the best person.
That's cool.
And they were like, well, I don't know. Okay. So they had a Green Beret. The first Green Beret I ever saw showed up in Germany. He was wearing his Green Beret and he was changing units. I don't know why. He was an older guy, and they put him in charge of running the event. So he set up like a three-day event with a PT test, a 12-mile ruck march, swimming, land navigation, tactics. He set this whole competition up for over a three-day period, and I ended up winning it. And so I got to go to German Ranger School, but I didn't speak enough German. And so they sent another guy with me that spoke German, and he failed out after the first week. So I was alone for the rest of the month and a half there. And that was kind of a breakdown for me. A lot of how you get over things is through comedy and telling stories at night when you're sitting around, you know, pulling security. And I'm trying to tell stories to these Germans, and they're looking at me like, what? And I'm like, all right. So I literally grabbed my boots and walked out to pull security, you know, and I'm shining my boots. I just started crying. There was just nobody to talk to. I was tired and miserable and lonely. Yeah. And I kind of got over that hump and passed German Ranger School. And so I decided I wanted something different other than going to the motor pool every Monday and working on our M113 APC, you know.
What's that?
It's armored personnel carrier. It's not a tank. It's just a troop carrier. You know, you got machine guns on top, but the back will open up and everybody can peel out. Now they're Bradleys.
Okay.
So every Monday, motor pool Monday, you know, driving that thing all week and then parking it. And then Monday back to the motor pool. It's just the same over and over again.
Yeah.
And I wanted something different. So I tried to reenlist for Special Forces. They had like a $25,000 bonus program.
And what made you decide to try that?
I knew I was going to stay in versus I came in for 4 years to get $25,000 for college and then get out. I knew after going through those schools that there was more and it was fun and challenging. So I decided I would reenlist to be a Green Beret, and the bonus made it easy, but I couldn't get the bonus. I had made E5 so fast that I didn't get a school you needed to get E5. I got promoted E5 because I won Soldier of the Year. I'm doing some competitions, and I had one soldier year, so they sent me to the E5 board, and basically their question was, my first sergeant, who was an old Vietnam vet, and our company was the 54th Engineer Battalion Raiders, and sitting in the board in front of all these sergeant majors for the E5 board, he's like, I just have one question for you. He's like, who runs this motherfucker? And I was like, I jumped up to attention. I'm like, Raiders run this motherfucker, first sergeant? He's like, that's all I got. Sit down. I sat back down, and he looked over, and he's like, no one else has questions, right? They're like, no, first sergeant. And so he goes, get out of here. And I got out of there and he came out and he's like, all right, you're E5. And I was like, okay.
That was easy.
Cool. I'll take the pay. So I didn't have primary leadership development course.
That's funny.
Which I was supposed to go through. But you have to have it to go to SF. But I couldn't get the school because I was already E5. They're like, let all the E4s go first. You know, let them get promoted.
Yeah.
So I went ahead and just reenlisted for jump school just to get to Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Okay.
And I knew when I was in Fort Bragg, that's where Home of Special Operations was. I could dig around and find something. So I come back in 89. Yeah, about the summer of 89, I came back to Fort Bragg, went to jump school, ended up at Fort Bragg, and then I started hunting down the Green Beret recruiters.
Okay.
And then signed up and went in the end of 89. I went to SFAS, the Special Forces Assessment and Selection Course.
What was the training like for that?
It's about a month long. They take you out to Camp McCall on Fort Bragg, and they put you in some, well, now they're nice, but there were some old barracks back in the day. They give you 4 hours of sleep a night, and during that 4 hours, you have a 15-minute period you have to pull fire guard. So you have to wake up before that 15-minute period to get dressed, and after you're done with fire guard, you wake the next guy up once he's ready. You lay back down, you try to go back to sleep, so you're getting about maybe 3 hours of sleep a night.
Right.
I think they did some research. It was like 4 hours a night is what you need not to go crazy.
Right.
You know, so that's what they kept it at for the month.
Came a little less than that.
Do some classes, do some land nav, lots of team events where you'll have maybe 12 guys on a team with your rucksack and your weapon and food and water, and you're carrying everything. And you'll have to push, say, like a Jeep, a 3/4-ton Jeep with 3 tires on it. and some poles over here and some stuff you can build with, and you got to push it like through the sandy roads for like 6-7 miles. Once you get there, you do about 2 events a day, and you get to the other end, they're like, all right, drop everything. Okay, here's about 50 sandbags. You got to fill each sandbag up to only where there's a fistful on the top. You got to carry these sandbags 500 meters and drop them off. Okay, sure. So we get 50 sandbags, we carry them, and along the way there's these berms, these huge berms you got to climb over all the way there, and drop them off, and you get to the end, the other guy's like, nope, not full enough, dump it out, go back and fill it up. So you do that all day for hours just to see who quits, you know?
Just kind of messing with your mind a little bit.
Exactly. Just, yeah. You're not allowed to encourage each other, you're not allowed to yell at each other, you're just supposed to work together.
Yeah.
And the guys start losing it, you know? And there's guys that just can't do it, but you have to keep them with you.
Yeah.
So it gets frustrating that you got a guy that can't carry anything, he can't walk that fast. Okay, you take the map, you navigate, just stay ahead of us.
Yeah.
And they can't do that. So it gets really frustrating.
You and learn. Do they drop or are they?
They do drop. Yeah. Nobody gets cut really, but a lot of people quit.
Yeah.
And even the instructors are like, who wants pizza? Pizza, all you have to do is quit, you know? And some guys really jump on that and go. I don't think anybody ever gets pizza. But you'll do things like that. You know, here's a 3/4 ton trailer with one wheel, and here's a bunch of metal poles to counterbalance it, you know, and you all have to stay together. Or here's an event where, you know, ammo cans, wooden ammo crates full of lead and sand that you got to carry as teams. Just all week long you're doing events. And it finishes up with a 22-mile road march all the way back into Bragg for time, and then testing and psychological evaluation. So made that. And then starts, you know, I was going for an 18 Charlie, Special Operations Engineer Sergeant. So that was easy for me. That 6 months of training after that to get the Green Beret was easy because they have weapons, then they have commo, they have engineers, and then they have the medics, and then they have the intel guys. Okay. So I was going to be an engineer. I already knew all the formulas. I'd already memorized them over my years in the Army. Basic training, I knew them because they drove them into you at Leonardwood, but I knew all the demo formulas. I knew all the calculations and where to place all the charges on bridges and roads and trees and things like that. So that was easy. Just learning all the unconventional warfare things and how to deal with foreign armies and how to get them to do what you need them to do when they don't really listen. You don't speak the language.
So foreign armies that you're working with in different parts of the... So, like, what are some of the things that you learned to do that for that?
Well, you have to learn how to teach everything you know. Instead of just knowing it and doing it, you have to learn how to teach it. So you go.
Are you learning their cultures too? And
yeah, absolutely.
How to influence.
Yeah. So you'll take over like by, with, and through, and you work by them or with them or through them, or you'll get them to do the job for you. And that's their legacy mission as a Green Beret. Since the war started, everybody's assaulting and attacking and capturing people. But and then you'll have like regular army units are flying in to train these armies back up. Once you take down the country, you have to train their army back up to defend itself, so you don't have to be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
Does it work? I don't know. We're still in Germany. Yeah. We're still in Japan. Yeah. You know, we'll be in Iraq forever. We'll have to be in Afghanistan forever. It just takes a long time to train, change the culture. The people have to want to do it. They're so used to a way of life that it's foreign to them, even though to us it's normal to live free and natural. And to go shopping and be nice to each other, to them, it's just more rudimentary.
It's a complete shift in a way of being. It's
A lot of people are like, you don't like Walmart? You don't like to show up and go to Walmart? People are like, I hate Walmart. It's like, I want to go to shopping every day for my food, and it's fresh, and that's what I'm used to.
Yeah.
So it'd be like trying to get us to go shopping every day
because we don't have a refrigerator. You know, who are we to impose our exact way of living on
right.
a completely different type of culture, which makes sense.
But. That's what's tough when you're a Green Beret. And I never did the legacy mission as a Green Beret. I was in such a short time before I already had selection to go to Delta.
Okay.
So I was only in 5th Special Forces Group at Fort Campbell, Kentucky for several months.
So what is the difference between Delta and Green Beret and some of the other Special Forces?
So you've got SEALs. You've got white side SEALs, which are not special ops. I mean, they're special ops, but they're not. You got white and black side. So let's say SEAL Team 6 is black side. White side SEALs, you have multiple teams on the East Coast and West Coast. And they're more like, let's say, Rangers.
Okay.
You know, Rangers are also special ops, but they're at a different level. They're more like shock. You know, go in and take something down, large numbers of people.
So, black ops meaning like...
Like more secretive, you know.
Yeah.
So they call it white side or black side. And then you have different tiers, tier one and tier two. And then everybody nowadays is an operator. That's just a cool term.
Yeah. How has that shifted just given our culture with social media and the truth coming out. I mean, I remember growing up just hearing the word Navy SEAL or even Delta Force was like, who are these guys? And now it's like, you know, you get your own movies and you've got, you know, everybody knows about SEAL Team 6 with...
Yeah. Rangers, you're allowed to be in the Rangers, talk about the Rangers. There's really nothing secretive about what you're doing, where you live, and where you're stationed, other than the jobs you do.
Yeah.
Nobody ever wants to tell where you're going and when. You know, that's just that's a big giveaway. Same with the Whiteside SEALs. A lot of the SEAL stories you hear are Whiteside SEAL stories. So, and they have a kind of a problem with too much social media going out. They're trying to put a cap on it. And that's why, even at Asymmetric, we SEAL Soft Day. Okay, SEAL is a bigger word. People know it more because it's been in the movies and books more.
Yeah.
Not a lot of Delta. Even when I say it, now that I've been out since 2010, it's like I kind of whisper it sometimes. And I've actually been attacked by wives in the unit now that I'm doing speak engagements. You said Delta. You're not allowed to say Delta. And I'm like, yeah, you are. When you're in, you're not allowed to.
Mm.
Never. You know. But when you're out, it's in your paperwork. You know, it's public information. You're allowed to talk about it.
And I'm sorry, what was the difference between, like, say, Delta Force and SEALs?
Oh, that's a trick question. that's people listening will be like, oh, what's he going to say now? You know what? I would say it's maturity and the selection process for SEAL Team 6. To go be a SEAL, you go to BUDS training.
Right.
And then you have Hell Week. And every SEAL goes through that. And that's kind of designed because the Navy comes in and their jobs are different. In the Army, you come in and you're a soldier first. Everyone goes to basic training. You learn how to use a gun. You learn how to do individual movement techniques and how to attack a building or how to assault through a field. So it's ingrained in you from day one.
Okay.
SEALs are in the Navy or in Air Force, things like that. That's not their sole mission. So they learn a different job. They don't learn those basic tactics on the ground right away.
Right.
So they have to go through BUDS, do a lot more of that tactical training, and then go through the SEAL training to get their tried and become a SEAL. They're learning it for the first time, and they're a lot younger. So maturity is one thing. Age and maturity is
actual emotional maturity.
Right. Okay. Right. They're a lot younger. The youngest age to go into Delta is probably 23.
Huh.
And I think I went in right at 23.
Okay.
You have to have been in the Army or the military and on your second enlistment. So you have to show a little commitment. You have to be a certain rank, E5 to E8, to come in, or officers have to come in after their first command. And I think if they come in as a captain, you know, they're going to be major really soon anyway, mm-hmm. and they've already had a command. So they've already been out into the regular military. They've already led troops.
Is the maturity requirement because you're dealing with other cultures and villages and...
Plus the national command missions, the higher level missions that just really no fail missions, you know, and it requires a lot of maturity, a lot of being quiet, not talking about it.
Mm.
So that's why you hear a lot less stories about Delta, less books on Delta. I don't know if there's ever been a movie on Delta other than Chuck Norris made one way back in the day. And there was a TV show, which is kind of way off, you know, the Delta Force back in the day. You'll see references in movies, and it's funny when we watch movies. You'll see them, oh, we're going to bring in some special ops guys, and they'll come in with the beards and the long hair, and they're acting kind of quiet in the corner, and the crazy guys over here, like, oh, those are the SEALs. See those badass over there? Those are Delta guys. Like, oh, and I'm like, we laugh all the time because it's like that, just what people think, you know?
What's the truth?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more quiet professionalism in the unit, just due to maturity level and the culture. And SEAL Team 6, great guys as well. And even all the other Whiteside SEAL teams, a lot of great guys. But they're younger, they're bigger. And when you're bigger, you have more opportunity for mistakes in there and people screwing up. So our numbers are really low.
Bigger in terms of numbers?
Numbers, yeah. They've got 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 on the East Coast. 6 being, you know, the black side. And then they have 1, 3, 5.
That's where they're stationed.
7 and 9 on the West Coast. Okay. Yeah, so they're huge. Rangers are huge. Green Berets are huge. The unit very small compared to that. Very small. Yeah.
So where did you do your training? So I'm sorry. So you went into you trained for Green Beret.
Yes, that correct? 6 months for that.
Okay, and then
how did I went you get to language into... school. So yeah, I'm going through the qualification course, the 6 month qualification course, and there was 2 or 3 guys from the unit that went through. They were already in the unit, but they went to the Green Beret qualification course to change their MOS, their military occupation specialty. Because when you're in the unit, when you're in Delta, you're still, there is no basic MOS for Delta. It's just you come over as a Ranger, you'll wear your brown beret now. If you're Green Beret and you go to Delta, you'll wear your Green Beret. If you're an airborne guy and you made it, you'll just wear your Maroon Beret. You'll wear all the same patches. There's no patch for Delta. You know, it's and so you get promoted with your peers in that job in the regular Army. Now, your packet that goes before the board is stamped secret. That sounds special to some people.
Right.
You've done more, you know, they take into consideration that you're in Delta and they know that you're doing a difficult job and you're training all the time, but you still kind of get promoted along with your peers in the regular Army. So if somebody was over there and they were a mechanic or something and they made it, they may want to go to the Q course because Green Berets get promoted faster than mechanics. Okay. You know, so these guys were over there going through the Q course to change their job in hopes of getting promoted. And I didn't know it. You know, I just think they're guys going through the Q course. And when I made the Q course and I'm in 4 months of Persian Farsi on Fort Bragg taking language school, and two guys showed up at our course and I'm wondering why they weren't in language school. You know, they don't need a language in Delta.
I'm sorry, which language? Farsi?
Farsi, okay. Persian Farsi. Yeah, Iran.
No.
I wasn't fluent after I took the course. That was a nightmare. That was 4 months of futility for me trying to learn that. I mean, I learned some stuff, but it's all gone now.
It's hard.
It's a horrible language to try to learn. And then to try to write it.
Backwards, yeah.
Yeah, no. One guy in the class actually learned how to write and everything. He had the capacity for it. Huh. He was just a brain. Me, I wasn't into it. When I realized how difficult it was, I was like, it's not happening. I'm just not happening. And they approached me and they said, hey, we watched you in the Q course, worked with them. You know, I knew them. I just didn't know where they were or where they were from. So I said, we think you have what it takes. You should try out for Delta.
Hmm.
So they actually gave me the phone number, and I called the recruiter when I was in language school and set up a time to do the PT test and take some psychological testing. And I did it. They said, yeah, all right, you're approved, and gave me a spring of 91.
What was it that they saw in you? Was it the...
Just my determination, my physical fitness, my motivation, maturity. I'd already spent 3 years in Germany leading people, and that's a whole other nightmare that you don't really get in special operations because you work around other professionals.
Yeah.
So leading people in the unit was easy. Leading people in the Green Berets is a little more easier than leading regular Army soldiers who have all kinds of problems and issues and don't care, half of them, you know, that they might be in because they have to be in or they have no other option. So it's more difficult. So I kind of learned a little bit about leadership in Germany, and I guess it shined through a little bit. But
gotcha. So take us now to, I was amazed in the research that I did that really the battle at Mogadishu was your first, like, real, I mean, I guess you had taken some fire in some other battles or whatever, but this was your...
All still Somalia, yeah.
Man, like, what an initiation.
Right. It was 2 years in the unit at the time. I got in spring of 91. By the end of 92, I'm now an operator in C Squadron. And so I've got one full year on me, you know, before I have to jump out and go to Somalia. So we just trained all the time, you know, preparing to do your job, save a life, take a life, whatever, but every day. And then Somalia's kicking up. You know, we start rehearsing months out, knowing that it's coming up. And then when it finally came down and we went over, it was like, okay, you're now Task Force Ranger. You'll have to shave your heads and blend in with the Rangers.
Wow.
So it was kind of funny because we all had a little bit longer hair at the time. And so, all right, you need a high and tight. So basically, guys are getting haircuts the day that they're going to the airfield to take off. So everybody's, all the Rangers, their heads are tan already because they've had that haircut for so long. Except you can see all the guys with the white heads, you know, and the tan lines on the sides. And it's like, okay, I can obviously tell these guys are different, you know. And
so what was going on in Somalia at the time?
Starvation. Mohammed Adid was using starvation as a tool, using the food, taking the food from the shipments that we were sending over there and taking down convoys. I think what caused us to pack up and start to go over was they attacked the Marines, killed some Marines over there in a convoy.
Okay.
I think they killed some military police, and then they attacked some Pakistanis as well.
Okay.
So it was like, okay, we need to take out Adid, which our charter is hostage rescue or kill capture. So, all right, let's go over and capture or kill Adid, you know, and his top people. So we had a list of people we wanted to go for in hopes of dismantling that clan and turning it over to a more friendly clan that wanted to help out with the starvation efforts.
Can I ask you sort of a slightly different question on this. Like, what is the U.S.'s interest in that? I mean, I know that that's a shitty situation, but...
Yeah. Probably just being the good guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the starvation was going on for so long, and you see them on the TV starving, and I think public opinion started spiking. Why aren't we helping these people?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it gets big enough that, all right, now we have to act and go help these people, sure, whether we had interest or not over there. At the time, I couldn't say, other than public opinion starts screaming out,
gotcha,
we should help these people. So, all right, so the administration decides we have to go help these people. So we go to help the people, and they attack us. They're stealing the food. It's not working. So now maybe it's okay. Let's take a more strategic approach to it. Let's mm-hmm. take out the leaders and then see if we can go back to negotiations. Because, you know, combat is just an arm of politics. Basically, I want you to do this. I want you to do this. Oh, well, I kind of only want to be part of this. If you come to an impasse and it has to happen, it's like, okay, combat. Reach out and smack them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you should pull back and go, now do you want to deal?
Mm-hmm.
Now do you see what's up? You can't do both at the same time, which
mm-hmm.
is where we fail, I think, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We try to do political maneuvers while we're in combat, and it doesn't really work. It's like, reach out, smack them hard, pull back. Now you want to talk?
Yeah.
Now let's talk about
mm-hmm.
your survival in your future versus us still coming after you for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, people still think they can get away with stuff and keep going, you know?
Yeah, I would not want to be on the receiving end of that. So Adid is basically being an ass.
Being an ass. Taking all the money, taking all the food, and using starvation as a tool to win the war.
And so you guys are charged to go over there to take him out.
Yes.
So, and as I've heard, this was supposed to be like a 30-minute operation? Like,
right. We had done five missions before 3 October, five or six missions before 3 October, and, you know, with limited success. We captured Osman Otto, his financier, on the hit before, which I think they showed in Black Hawk Down.
Okay.
He's riding the bike, and then they take out the car. It didn't really go down that way. There was nobody on a bike. Definitely nobody sitting in the market. But those five or six missions, you know, some shots were fired. Nobody got hurt on our side. We captured who we wanted to, mostly. And did it lead to anything? Not really. The Osman Otto capture, I think, led us a little bit closer to locations, and we had people, some locals out in the city, you know, would put a panel on top of their car if there was a meeting going on, and he could confirm that people were there. So on 3 October, helicopters flying overhead, and I guess the guy put the signal on top of his car. There's a meeting going on right now. And so that's how little time we had to launch.
So this was a Somali that was working
right
with you guys.
Yeah, for money.
So he puts just something on top
of it. Some little marker on top of his car, something, you know, that nobody else would notice, but the helicopter's looking for. They know what car he is, where he's at, and if he puts it on top, it's time to launch. If nothing's on top, he goes, and he was getting nervous. I remember he was getting really nervous, like, hey, they're going to notice me. This is weird. And finally the signal went. And me and some other guys had just gotten back from like a five-mile run around the airfield and along the beach. And it was Sunday, and it was about 2 o'clock, and we just got back, sweaty and tired, ready to go eat some dinner, you know? And everybody was stirring a little bit.
Oh, so you didn't know?
No clue.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And they're like, get it on. And basically, get it on was what you got. So run inside, put on my kit, bottle of water, you know, no night vision because it's 2 in the afternoon and it's going to be about an hour, you know, say about an hour long mission at the most. Go in, grab them, get out. So I was going to fly in, rope down, assault the building, and then the convoy would drive in and would load everybody up on the convoy and drive out. Because
so how far away was your base from where you need
maybe
to go?
3 miles, maybe three
You're
or four.
That close to each other?
Oh, yeah.
That
we're at the airfield.
Other,
we're at
crazy.
The airfield. It would be like being at the St. Louis airfield and attacking, well, whatever little town is about 3 miles away, you know?
Right.
And mostly friendly around the airfield, but then the other parts of town where the Bad Clan, you know, in the Bakara market where they sold all the black market weapons and everything.
Right.
So we load up, get on, we're sitting on the bird. Birds are cranking. We're waiting on our team leaders to come out of the talk and tell us what's going on. You basically get a white piece of paper in front of your face. You know, we're going to go in here. Here's about 4 or 5 buildings, you know. You'll run this way through the dust because you can't see because when the helicopter comes in, there's so much brown out you can't see. So you're roping down into the dirt. You don't see anything. And then you just, okay, go that way. And running until it clears. You're like, all right, where are we? All right, go. And then
that's your whole
briefing
of...
Right.
Wow.
We could have planned it better, but by the time we're done planning, they're gone.
Sure.
You know? So had to get there. As soon as we start infilling, we're taking fire. I mean, our helicopter had to flare and hover outside of the security zone because the Rangers would set up an outer perimeter and we would go in and hit the target and they would just keep people out. Mm-hmm. We inserted outside of that just due to the brownout. The helicopter couldn't see, so we pulled up short. We roped down. It was like, all right, where are we now? So we had to get off the street because we're getting taken fire already. We kicked in somebody's door, took the family down, set them down in the corner, told them it's okay. You know, they had babies and everything. It's just so surreal.
Oh, man.
And you're trying to be nice, but you got to go, and bullets are flying. It's like, I just stay here, you know.
Yeah.
They don't understand what you're saying, so you're just trying to be nice in hand gestures with guns and helmets and bullets flying.
That's
and
crazy.
We finally get out and work our way down the street back to the target building. And we had about 12 or 14 that we had detained, and we handcuffed them, kind of asking questions, looking around, searching the buildings. It's time to go, you know. And then a 5-ton outside got hit with an RPG. And was on fire. And it was like, oh, okay, it's starting to ramp up a little bit. You know, this we need to get out of here now.
Yeah.
We're still joking, like, oh, I hope we make it back for dinner. You know, I got some good food tonight. And
really? Wow.
Still cracking jokes. Moved out of that building, put the detainees on a 5-ton, and moved into a courtyard of another house. And I was carrying, like, a big sack of Somali money, like a whole garbage bag full of money. It's like, I'll take this back. I found it in a safe. Probably worth $5. I don't know. You know, a lot of their money is none of ours. But and hear an RPG launch. Look up. You see the tail rotor of the helicopter start spinning out of control, heading off to the north and the east. Mm. And I was like, well, all right, mission just changed.
Just
you know.
Yeah.
And they're sitting there waiting on the radio. They're calling in. Okay, we need the convoy to go here. We need you guys to move down the street about 3 blocks east and 2 or 3 blocks north and find the crash site. And you got to get there now because the Somalis are moving that way.
Right.
And we didn't know it at the time, but the reason they were so good with the RPGs that day was there was an Al-Qaeda training cell several blocks away from our target area. And they were there in full force, and they just came to the party, you know. And they had all their weapons, and they were definitely better trained than the militia.
Interesting.
So they were hitting them. And they had modified, I'd heard they had modified their RPGs to blow up in the air. And I think they filled some with gas so they could try to hit these helicopters. Instead of trying to hit a helicopter moving, they could hit near it. And damage it, you know.
Interesting. So, and you didn't know about these guys until after?
Not until years later. Didn't even know they were there. Didn't even know Al-Qaeda really existed. It wasn't on a public opinion. I mean, they were they're that old.
So the bird goes down. You guys are a few blocks away. You're tasked now to go basically check for survivors. And
Try to go get survivors and defend the helicopter site, get the wounded out, and then head back. So as we finally start, we're just getting ready to push out. And over there, they have those cinder block and rock wall courtyards, and then the gates are just thin metal. I remember standing there watching. There was a ranger sitting against the metal gate just taking a breather, leaning up against it, and his just neck explodes, you know. It just took a bullet right through there. And I was like, we got to get out of here.
Yeah,
you know, we got to get out of here. So they load him up on the convoy. The convoy is going to go back, and first they try to make their way to the crash site. And
if I could just pause you for a second, like, what do you, since this is your first real shitstorm, basically, like, what's going through your mind? How are you processing? Like, is this did the training just kick in and just became second nature? Are you?
It is. It's muscle memory.
Yeah.
It's my mind shuts down, and even years after that, when I'm in charge and people are getting hurt and people I know are getting hurt, my mind shuts down. It's just I have a job to do. I can't care about that right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I care about that, then my job's going to suffer. So. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking that guy got shot in the neck. I'm like, oh, damn, man, I'm glad that wasn't me, you know, but dang, we got to go.
Yeah.
And load him up, and we start heading down the street, and every intersection we cross, it was just a volume of fire. And I remember looking up as we cross one, and there's just hundreds of Somalis paralleling us. They're heading to the crash site. They're already closer. They're a little bit north by a block or two. So we know we have to give up security and use speed to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So we drop a lot of security where we'd normally lay down weapons, clear the street, and then send guys across. We just went, you know, we just had to go. And nobody really got hurt or hit until we turned north. And right at the corner from turning north, we got held up a little bit because that was a crash site street. And there was already a lot of people down there. And unknown at the time, there had already been a couple of our guys that got out of the helicopter and had launched out to shoot at these guys that were approaching the helicopter and gotten killed. They took a little bird and landed it right there at the intersection. And you can see one
guys?
Guy. Yeah, our guys.
Okay.
Task Force guys. Little bird right there. The pilots were shooting out the window, you know.
Cool.
And it can only hold about 2 or 4 guys. And so one of our assaulters went over and grabbed the guy who just got shot, a friend of mine, and was dragging him to the bird. And as he was dragging him to the helicopter, he got shot through the shoulder, finished dragging him, threw himself on the bird, and that bird got out of there. And then that's about probably the time we turned the corner to head north and started taking a large volume of fire. So we're out in the street, spread out, trying to suppress that fire so we could push forward, shooting two or three grenades, you know, two or three is a grenade launcher, 40-millimeter grenade launcher, shooting those down the street. And that's when I looked over and saw a couple of friends of mine on the other side of the street shooting. And the east side of the street was more lit, I think, with the sun and everything. And they seemed to take it more than we did on our side of the street at the time. And I look back and I see two of my friends dragging another guy, lifeless body. Earl had just got shot in the head. And that was the last movement he ever made. And that's as far as they pushed forward. They had to hold up there. They took so many casualties. Our side, we pushed down further, all the way to the crash site, and we took the house. There was a four-way intersection. Helicopters crashed on the eastern side.
And I'm sorry, is this a residential area?
Residential, yeah.
So there's
people everywhere.
Oh, my gosh.
There's people everywhere.
There's militia everywhere.
Militia, people, women, kids just popping in. And I'm like, what are these people doing? If I hear gunfire, I'm getting out of here.
Oh, my God.
I guess they're so used to
it. I mean, is it just a way of life?
Yeah, that's the weird stuff. The things that aren't natural. I mean, it's natural to see people get shot in combat, I guess, but it's not natural to see people calmly walking around and see what's going on. And you got to deal with them too, but you just don't have time to deal with them. You have to just get them out of the way, you know, because those are the people that get you killed. So we had to take those two houses down. Our house had a family of probably six kids up to, you know, low teens. And two adult females and one adult male. Mm. And we cuffed the adult male, put him in the corner, and left all the women sitting with him in the living room as far back from the shooting as we could, because now they're under our protection. We have to keep them safe. And that was the only rest position you had that night, was guarding those people. That's where you got rest. Everybody else was in a window or a door outside around the building. And that's where we spent, you know, the next 16, 18 hours, basically. Just keeping people away from the helicopter. And then the convoy can't get to us. They keep trying to get to us, but they don't know where we're at. The helicopter's calling down on the radio, turn right now. And by the time they got that communications, they were already past it.
Oh,
so now they're getting lost over and over again.
That's the other thing we take for granted today. I'm sure our convoy are way better today.
Yeah, or navigation. You go straight to it. You know,
right.
Everybody's got a little Blue Force tracker. You know where everybody's at.
Oh,
back then, I had no idea where anybody was.
Oh, that's crazy.
So before you shoot, you have to figure out, okay, well, you do anyway, but you had to take a little extra care back in the day. Are those our people? Are they, you know, before you shoot back? So that spent the entire night there.
And so just for the listeners to understand, again, I mean, this was a 30 to 60 minute op that's now turned into a multi-hour. So your gear, I mean, you have hardly not anything, right?
Nothing.
I mean, you're...
I had a little bottle of water. We were light and fast, plastic helmets. I had sewn my own Kevlar. You know, the Army, you get Kevlar. I'd taken it apart.
Yeah.
Went to the sew shop and sewed it the smallest little, you know, like a little Kleenex on my chest. Just to have it.
Yeah.
And plastic helmets, no night vision, just your weapon, ammo that you needed, and med supplies. You know?
So I'm assuming you don't have a ton of ammo for that.
We ran out.
Fight.
Yeah.
I mean, so how did you guys last that long?
Little birds. Little birds,
mini
guns, and rocket launchers.
Okay.
And they were keeping people at bay. We were very selective in our fire. We had a lot of ammunition from the wounded that couldn't use it. We were taking. We still ran out. And then they resupplied us midway through the night with water and ammunition. But back in the day, we didn't prepackage it.
Okay.
We didn't have a package in magazines and water and ruggedized containers that they threw out. So here comes a Black Hawk hovering right over us, throwing stuff out. They start taking fire from the house right next door to us from the second floor. And that's where a friend of mine got shot in the face. Mm-hmm. Throwing stuff out, and as it hits the road, it's exploding into the dirt right in front of our building. And it's like, okay, I'm the younger guy on the team. Hey, Tom, you got to go get that. And I'm like, that's great, and I can't wait.
When you say exploding, you mean
just the boxes? Yeah, the boxes tearing apart, ammo laying everywhere, the water just hitting and dumping. And so now it's my turn to go out in the street, and I go out there, I'm scooping up ammunition and running it back in. Go back out, scoop up more ammunition, run it back in, water, run it back in. And it's like, okay, the team across the street needs water. I'm like, okay, I'll run it across the street now, you know? So here I am waiting with 2 5-gallon jugs of water, like, all right, one, two. And the streets, you know, regular sized dirt, probably 1.5 lanes wide, maybe in a residential area. I'm like, I'm looking at the front door, kind of waiting to leave the gate, take off running, you know, as fast as I can, carrying 2 5-gallon jugs of water. And it's like slow motion. Up until I get to the door frame of the house that I'm running into at full speed. And my mind's like, what if I get shot by my own guys as I run in, you know? So I run in there and yelling, eagle, eagle, eagle. And I don't hear anything. And I'm like, am I in the right house? Yeah. You know, I have no gun. I my gun's on me, but my hands are full of water.
Yeah.
And I'm going through this house trying to find the team. And finally, I find them in the back. They're dealing with some people coming up the back alleyway. And I, here's your water. I dump it off and I go back. And I'm like, now I got to go back across the street again. I'm like, this sucks. So made it back. But yeah, all night, just different incidences that happened. You know, the Rangers out in the corner of the building got hit with an RPG. Had to go out and drag them in. And then they sent me back out to go get their weapon that was, they had an M60 out there. Go find their weapon so nobody uses it. Like, I'm pretty sure it's destroyed. That RPG did a number on that building. Mm-hmm. Got that weapon in there. Took care of those Rangers. They're just picking at us all night long. Remember my buddy sitting in a room, pulling guard out the window towards the crash site and north. And I just got up off the bed. He sat down, and I was rotating in to guard the family. And I turned around to ask him if he needed any water, because there was a little pipe dripping water out of the building, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, I'll throw some iodine tablets in it, and I'll fill it up with water and hand it out to people during my break. And I turned around to ask him a question, and the wall just exploded.
Oh, man.
And it was full of dust, and I saw this red rocket spinning in circles, bouncing off things in the room, and then lodge underneath the couch. And I was just standing there covered in, like, debris. And my 2IC was sitting in a couch in the hallway looking up at me as I was covered in this stuff. He's like, what was that? I go, I don't know. And then it hit me. I yelled, RPG, and I went running into that room. And that rocket had hit so close that the rocket hadn't burned out, and it was still spinning around the room, and it caught the couch on fire. I'm trying to find my buddy in this debris, this dust-filled room in the dark. And I found this, I thought it was his leg, and I went to pull it, and he comes up just and knocked out of him, just wailing, you know. And I drug him out, put him in the other room, and shut that door. I was like, now that we have this huge hole in this house. So I just shut the door for a bit.
What did the RPG?
It knocked the whole wall down.
But did it explode? I mean, it was still...
No, it exploded.
Oh, okay.
Blew the wall, but RPG is like a shape charge. It's designed for metal.
Right.
It'll punch a hole through metal. So when it hits concrete or dirt, it does some damage, but it really absorbed it all. So he just got a little shock knocked into him. You know, he wasn't injured. He laid there for like an hour or so and recovered, and he was back at it, but... I shut the door, and I'm standing there, and I notice 20 minutes later, there's a red glow coming underneath the door, and I'm like, what's going on there? And I open the door, and the couch is on fire. And the whole room's full of smoke. I'm like, this is not good.
Yeah.
I was worried about the light drawing attention to where we were anyway.
Was the family in there still?
No, the family's in the living room, just across the hallway. Like, what's going on with my house, you know? Okay. So I'm trying to find water, flower pots, pouring it on this couch that's on fire. And every time I'd go in there, I'd breathe in that smoke and the chemicals from the couch. Who knows who makes that over there? I'd go outside, throw up, come in, get some more water, pour it out, go outside, throw up, come back in, and finally put that fire out. And that's when I started walking around the house laying mattresses up against the walls, because I knew that it stopped it, but now let's stop the debris. And I just finished laying a mattress up on one of the other walls that a buddy of mine was sitting at. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, it's just a little more protection, you know? I was turning around and walked out, and that wall got hit right after I put that mattress up. And he came out, he's like, that worked like a champ, you know? It stopped everything from flying in. They were just nitpicking our house all night long, just destroying it little by little, trying to sneak up on us the whole night, you know? I literally had one guy, as I was pulling guard, sitting on a bed, looking to the west. There's a house about 3 feet across and just a little dirt way between. And every now and then I'd hear men in there yelling, and you can hear them with their weapons and stuff. And I'd just shoot through the wooden shutters, trying to keep them away. And I was sitting there, and there was bars on our windows as well. And I heard this clicking and dragging noise, like metallic and wood, and then I'd hear a dragging noise, and I'm like, you know, I didn't have ear protection in, so I'm half deaf anyway. And I look out, and without night vision, I saw this guy in like a man dress put his AK in front of him and drag himself forward as he's creeping up on my window. And I'm like, oh, this is not cool. So I couldn't get my M4 out the window to shoot at that angle. So I'm thinking, okay, it's pistol time. I finally get to use my pistol, you know. Pull my 45 out, and I stick my arm to the bar, and I'm going to you know, get rid of his, you know, get rid of this issue. And I pull the trigger and the hammer falls and it's so full of sand from the rotor wash that the hammer only halfway falls. I'm like, okay, nothing else. What else can go wrong?
Yeah.
So I recocked the 45 and put it on the bed. I'm like, oh yeah, we got these little Austrian grenades, these little small ones, you know. I pulled it out and showed the guy standing at the door, and I pulled the pin, and he's going, no, no. And I'm like, yep. You know, I stuck my hand out the window again, and he's right underneath it now. And I dropped it, and I hit him on the head, and as it hit him, he looked up like, what is that? And it rolled down into his little scarf area, and I just laid over on the bed, and boom, and everything just kind of hits the ceiling inside. Everything blows in our room, and it's funny. It wasn't the first person I'd killed, but it's not funny. That's a bad word, but it's odd that when you do your job and you take a life, the first thing is in your mind is I'm in trouble. You know, I'm going to get in trouble. Mm. People came running in the room. What was that? What was that? I'm like, oh, it was a flashbang, like just a distraction device.
Yeah.
And the guy in the room with me standing there going, no, he's not. He's lying. That was a grenade. I'm like, yeah, you're right. It was a grenade. Look at this dude, you know? And like, oh, hey, good job.
But you know? Your reaction was to tell a white lie.
Yeah. Like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble for that, you know? And it was weird. So that went on. It became the longest sustained firefight since Vietnam at the time. I think there's been one longer now in Afghanistan, maybe, or maybe Iraq. I'm not sure, but 18 hours. It lasted a little over 18 hours.
Oh, man. So, I mean, you're not sleeping at all during any of that?
No. We were dehydrated, suffering from severe sleep deprivation.
And so how did you guys finally get out?
They finally made it to us just before light out, and two or three of the Pakistani armored vehicles had made it, and they were using one, and the 10th Mountain Group was with them, so we had more numbers now, and they kind of secured the area. They're out there walking around like it's normal. I'm like, you guys, trust me, we've been here all night. It's not cool to be walking out in the streets, but they're in force. You know, maybe they pushed everything back. They used the vehicle to pull the helicopter off of the pilots, because they'd been thrown through the windshield and they were underneath it, and we couldn't get their bodies out, and we weren't leaving without them. So finally pulled that off, got the bodies on top, got the wounded inside, and it was time to leave and put some thermite on the helicopter to destroy it. And then we had a Cobra and Apache that was going to also fly in and hit it with rockets on our way out to keep everybody back, and opened up the back of the armored personnel carrier to get in, and it was just so full of wounded. The guy just actually grabbed the door and pulled it shut again. Mm. And you see the latch go and shut it. And I'm like, well, and there's no room in there, man. Yeah. Like, we're going to have to follow them. We'll just follow along the vehicles.
On foot.
Wow. Whoever didn't get in. And we'll use the vehicles as cover. And we'll run back that mile to where everyone else is. And those vehicles took off. They just took off. Miscommunication. So we're like, all right, let's do this. We just start running back in the same direction we came. And all along the way, I remember passing our vehicle. It was an old Humvee that we had built. It was just a cargo Humvee, not armored or anything. Mm-hmm. And we had taken sandbags in the back and lined up a wall and put 3/4-inch plywood on both sides of it to hold the sandbags in and used like zip ties to hold that together. And we sat inside that and we built a bench inside for either wounded or to sit on. And we're sitting on that facing out. And I saw that sitting on the side of the road with a hole in it. It was burnt out. And I remember thinking, I wonder what happened to my buddy that was driving it, you know. He's dead. I didn't know it at the time. Mm. But turned the corner to go back west, and I remember stopping at one point to watch the Cobra or Apache, whatever it was, launch a rocket at the helicopter. I want to see what that did, you know. And he was hovering, didn't really do it. I'm like, I gotta go. I don't know what I'm doing. I turn around and everybody's gone. And I had this sinking feeling of, now I'm here. Now I'm all alone, you know? So I just took off running down the street.
What time of day is this again
at this point? Maybe it was light out, maybe 7 or 8 in the morning.
In the morning, okay.
And I just took off running. And as I got running along these walls, there's walls everywhere. You can never get off the street unless you live there, you know? There's gates and walls, and you're just kind of contained into the street. And I'm just running, hoping if I get up and look down an intersection, I'll see a group of guys running, you know? And as I run up, there's one little alcove that I didn't see, and one of the guys that was with us on the team jumped out, grabbed me, and threw me in there with the rest of the team right as an RPG hit the wall. He didn't do it because the RPG was coming. He saw me coming, and he jumped out to grab me. They pushed me in there, and the RPG hits the wall, and it kind of just the shrapnel that cut his ear and kind of deafened him a little bit. But that's all that happened to him, and we finally made it all the way back to where the other vehicles were. And it was just kind of chaos trying to figure out who's going to get in where. And the plan was, I didn't know it at the time, I just knew I was going to get in the vehicle and go somewhere, was to go to the Pakistani Stadium, which was maybe another mile away, closer, mm-hmm. downtown. And two guys from my team and two guys from another team loaded up in one Humvee with some 10th Mountain guys who were just shooting, ducked down, shooting into the city, you know. I'm like, what are you guys doing? Aim at something, you know. And tanks are shooting down the street at people, and our two Humvees took off. I'm thinking, well, they know what they're doing, right? So they take off, and we're taking fire, and everybody's just engaging back all along the way, and there's tires burning, and they start to slow down. I'm like, don't stop. Don't stop for anything. Just ram that. You know, the second you stop or they try to divert you to where they want you to go, I'm like, just go through it.
Yeah.
And at some point along the way, the shooting just kind of stopped, you know. You're in Good Clan area now. I think it was 4 October Road was a demarcation line between Good Clan, Bad Clan. Yeah, it was weird. And we just crossed that line, and everybody's still looking for things. Nobody trusts anybody now. And we drove all the way back to the back gate of the airfield. We get in the back gate, we stop, and we sit there, and our radios are dead. They've been on all night, so they're dead. No radio traffic. We're waiting to see if the convoy's coming behind us. I hadn't seen the convoy in a while. We sat there maybe 20 minutes. Nobody came. So I was like really worried like what happened. So we drove around the airfield, got back towards our hangar. And that's when I noticed, I don't know, 10 to 12 U.S. soldiers lined up in the side of the street, covered up. Mm. One of them had an RPG sticking out of his side that wasn't detonated. He was sandbagged around him because he got shot at such a close distance, it didn't have time to arm. So it's kind of like getting shot with a harpoon. You know, I didn't look at faces. I couldn't do it. I was looking at boots. I could tell uniforms. I'm like, man, it's not good. You know, I don't know where everybody's at all. Got back to the hangar. Nobody was there. There's vehicles everywhere covered in blood. There's blood all over the ground. I remember the smell of bleach and heat and sand mixed together as they used the sand to try to soak it up and the bleach to clean it out. And it was everywhere. And, I just went and started loading up my ammo, getting some water, grabbed my night vision in case, you know, it went longer again. It's like, when are we going back out? Who we got to go get? And, like, just stand fast. The other guys went to the Pakistani Stadium. They're supposed to take helos back. Why'd you come here? I'm like, I don't know. I got in the back of a vehicle and took off. I didn't have the plan. I was, like, six guys on our team. I was number five, you know. I had just gotten there. And number six was with me, so I had leadership.
You said you're at the hangar right now?
I'm at the hangar where we've been the whole time and we've lived.
Okay. Okay, so you're back at sort of...
Back at home, kind of safe. So we waited, and maybe an hour later, helicopters started coming in. Started bringing in guys from the Pakistani Stadium and dropping them off. Came back, and that's when we started getting the numbers of, you know, dead and wounded. And it was something like 90, 98 wounded and 18 KIA.
What's the mood? Like, how do you... It's so hard for me to even fathom how you even, like, what do? You go to bed? You go to
you eat, clean to weapons? Out, you clean weapons. Usually it's high fives and, hey, that was awesome. Everything went great. You know, did you see that guy run? Did you see what I did? You know, this time it was quiet. It was a lot of angry people. A lot of people were cleaning their weapons and getting ready to go back, loading up ammo. And then we started asking questions like, where's so-and-so? Have you seen so-and-so? He got wounded. He's in the hospital. He, you know, or he's dead, or he's over here. Or we don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. Find out Gary and Randy's missing, you know. There was another helicopter shot down. So I was like, what? Mm-hmm. And then we started watching the news. And that's where I learned a lot, was from watching the TV. We had a little room with a TV in it back in the back of the hangar. And I started watching the news. I'm like, ooh, I better watch. They're freaking out right now, you know. Mm-hmm. And no conversation. Back in the day, we had one satellite phone. You couldn't really use it to call home at all anyway. Just trying to figure out, how do I tell my wife?
Yeah, I'm surprised we got the news out that quickly. But
yeah, there was a lot of news crews over there running around. I don't know what country they were from, but definitely not U.S. But yeah, it was already on the news. Huh.
So are you in contact with family back home? Or can you?
No, what they were told was no news is good news. Right. You know, if you don't hear anything, that means your husband's probably okay. But years later, and with my wife working with other people, you find out, like, Carmen Gordon waited for days to find out what happened to her husband because he was missing. Is he dead or not? We don't really know.
That'd be horrible.
So he's missing. So to hear her story, my wife's got a book hopefully coming out. talking with Carmen and other wives of what they went through, and sitting on her front porch every day. You know, somebody would show up and bring her a McMuffin and a coffee, and sit and just talk, you know. And then I guess finally one day she got guys in uniform show up, mm-hmm. you know. But to hear her story, they delivered them, a couple of them back in garbage bags. Mm-hmm. You saw on TV, I think, in the day, them dragging bodies through the streets and stuff. But they burned them, chopped them up, and we got them in garbage bags. And so for years, I think in one of her stories, she talked about how she didn't throw any of his items away until maybe a couple of years ago. And her point was, I never want anything that he owned to go in a garbage bag because that's what he was in. You know, mm-hmm. It was just sad. But, yeah, it was horrible. No, I finally got to call home days later. Just say everything's all right, you know. It's horrible. Can't say anything anyway. Right. You know?
I'm sure just hearing your voice was enough.
I'm good. Yeah. Don't worry about it. You know, I don't think we're going out again. We don't have enough people to go out again, so there's another squadron on the way.
So... We went a lot longer on that whole story than I initially thought we would, but that was so compelling and kind of walked us through. I mean, I can't even, again, it's hard to even grasp what you guys went through. And so now you're in a place where obviously you've dealt with a lot of trauma. And when did you find out that you were really struggling with some PTSD stuff?
Oh, you know, it's probably after I almost killed myself. I just figured it's normal. I was angry. Time had gone by. It'd been about 20 years.
So you're out of the service at this point.
I'm out of the service. You know, I spent 20 years in the unit, 25 total in the Army. And I just did my job. You know, I was more angry. I didn't note it at the time, but talking to people that knew me back then, that know me now, like, you're so different. Your mm-hmm. face has changed. Your whole life has changed. Your body's mm-hmm. changed. Your personality has changed. I'm like, that's who I was before. But they met me after that, and it was just, I was angry, very serious. You know, everything's a life-changing event, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a dish in the sink. I freak out, you know, because somebody's going to die because of that. And I'm only finding out here recently that that's my coping mechanism, is to be rigid. From rigidity to chaos is where I feel safe. It's like, huh. I'm rigid about everything. That's my form of control. And that's how my brain, which perceives everything to be a threat, feels safe, is to control everything.
Because everything's
got to be perfect. You know, it's got to be perfect, just right, the way it's supposed to be. And there's a reason for it. And it better be that way. The dishes are supposed to be in the counter. It's supposed to be rinsed when you're done. Yeah, you know, I was a horrible person. I was angry. And then maybe 4 years ago, we were still doing some training in Ohio, and I was divorcing. I mean, it was evident. You know, I was separated. I started living in another bedroom in my house for 6 months, and then moved to a hotel for 6 months, and then finally got an apartment for a year. And just a slow breakup of just, you know, I was miserable. And just sticking around for my son at the time, you know, which was worse even for him, probably. And we had done training in Akron, Ohio, and we're finished. We're supposed to meet in the hotel lobby and talk about it later and have some drinks. And I parked in the parking garage, and guys jump out of the car. I'm like, I'll be in a minute. I'm going to just go through some paperwork. I don't even know what – I didn't plan it. You know, I didn't think about it. And I was done. I was like, this is it. You know, I was miserable. The day was like one of these days. What am I doing here? You know, why am I doing this? And I had my pistol with me. And I was like, started thinking, I put it in my lap, and I started thinking about, all right, do I put it in my mouth or do I put it inside of my head? Because I've heard stories like shotguns, you put it in your mouth and the pressure pushes your face back before the bullet actually hits you. So, you know, you blow back and you hit part of your face and now you're a vegetable and people have to take care of you. And I'm like, I don't want to screw this up. So I did the side of my head, do I pull it away an inch or two or do I put it right on there? And then my phone vibrates and it kind of scared me. And it was a text saying, hey, we're all in the lobby. Are you coming? And it was from one of the camera crew. And I'm like, oh, God, I'm late. You know, now I'm back to me. I'm late. Put my gun away. I'm like, what was I doing? I didn't even really think about it, you know?
Were you on any kind of medication or anything at the time?
Probably.
I mean, the fact that you went from just being another typical miserable day to I'm out, I'm done.
Yeah.
To, oh, I'm late.
I guess. I was miserable. I was probably on Prozac at the time. or maybe I'd stopped taking it. I don't remember anymore. I was doing a lot of drinking, obviously not during the day, but every night. So my, you know, it carries over, you know, your performance and I was gaining weight. I mean, I was unhappy.
Not in a good place, clearly.
No. And so I go down to the lobby, met up with everybody. And the person who texts me is my wife now, you know.
Oh, that's tired. your Facebook page is it's great. I mean, it's just you and her, and I'm like, man, this is, for somebody who's been through as much as you've been through, you're living a love story right now, and it's pretty cool.
It's all her, and it's not perfect. You know, everybody on Facebook is perfect. It's not perfect. I have a lot of issues daily that I still work with, but I get a lot of flack from some of my friends who just are resistant to culture change, but they don't realize they're still in the culture of killing and hate and anger and holding on to it. I get a lot of messages on there like, oh, are you hanging out a lot of your hippie friends? Or, man, you sure are changed. Are you drinking the Kool-Aid? I'm like, you know what? I see all these posts from friends of mine or the same job as mine or whatever, you know, and they're like, you snowflake libtards, blah, 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 sheeple, you flock of sheep just following. And I'm like, you know what? Aren't we all just sheep in a different flock? Mm-hmm. And we're defending our own flock? I mean, can't you step outside of that and think that there's other ways to solve problems and to think that you haven't been taught yet? I mean,
just a different perspective.
Right. I mean, stop attacking each other because of what you believe in and this and that. To fall on your sword for everything every day is just ridiculous. And it's just that anger. I just got back from Fayetteville. I was doing some business there. I got back yesterday. And so the night before last, I'm in a restaurant in Fayetteville where I used to hang out. You know, it's like a bar restaurant. And the place is packed. I'm looking around the room like, I used to know people here. Now it's just all young kids. Mm-hmm. And I went to the bathroom and I'm listening to this song in the bathroom playing. I remember sending my wife a text. The words to the song were like, basically, you know, kill, I'm going to die, I'm going to rock it tonight. It's just hard, heavy metal. I'm like, this is the culture that they live in, that they just, it's perpetuating it. Off duty, on duty, you know, after hours, it's always there. I'm like, wow, I never would have noticed this song before other than, oh, this is going to get me motivated to go out and kill people, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, man, this song is violent and evil, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just weird.
That's quite a change of tune from where you were.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to?
My wife. Literally my wife making me realize that I was that screwed up. Mm. That everything I held dear, and the fact that my brain thinks everything's a threat, which means I attack it, you know. And when I do talk to people, even when I work sometimes, it's like if I get a little resistance back and I don't agree with it, I'll start elevating my voice and I try to take over the situation and command everything. And it's like, she's like, what are you doing? I'm not your soldier, you know? Yeah. You yelled at that guy on the phone. I'm like, was I yelling? I wasn't yelling. It's just business, you know? But no, I was elevating it, you know, without need, really. It's just respect. Mm-hmm. Respect for yourself and other people. I've started learning that, you know? You have to respect yourself first, which I did not. Mm. I did not respect myself. I didn't like myself. I didn't like...
Prior to military service? Or
no, after.
After, just...
Just the PTSD is basically you don't like yourself. You don't like who you're becoming. You don't like your symptoms. You don't like anything, which means I can't like anybody else.
Right.
You know? So I started letting go of that, started appreciating what I did more, which made me want to change and be better and do more. And everybody I talk to now that's healthy and helping other people went through the same process. You know, they're like, why are we always fighting and arguing and killing people? It's not normal. It's what I did. And if somebody ever comes and tries to mess with my family, they're gonna find something very difficult in the way. But I don't need to argue every day and put on that persona every day. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous, really.
So was it really Jen then that sort of cracked that for you? And part of the reason why I'm asking this is because... people who might be listening who either have PTSD or have loved ones that are, you know, have it. My brother was hiking in the mountains not too long ago and had a friend slip and fall to his death. And, you know, or women who have dealt with rape. And I mean, that's incredibly traumatic.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people, I think, out there outside of just the military. Sure. I mean, a lot of times I think of PTSD as military related, but
no.
Trauma is trauma.
Right. I read that in a book. I got an audio book called Heal Your PTSD. I was listening to it yesterday for 5 hours at the airport. all exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
And it's always been that way. Trauma is trauma. Pain is pain. People are like, I'm so sorry about your back. You've had so many back surgeries. I'm like, doesn't matter if I got blown up or picked up a quarter and pulled a muscle. It's pain.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And PTSD is just a normal reaction to an unnormal experience.
That's such a great definition. Because I think a lot of people, I've talked to some of the guys down at Asymmetric Solutions or whoever else, and we've had these conversations, and it seems like they think that it's this unique, special thing, or that they're wrong for it, or it's some kind of disease, or it's a...
Right. No, it's absolutely normal.
Total normal, I would dare say, even say healthy coping mechanism for something that is almost improcessable.
Yeah.
An experience that is outside of...
Yeah. It absolutely is. And I keep saying PTSD. We're trying to switch to PTS because to call it a disorder means there's something wrong with you when it's a natural reaction, like, you know? So yeah. I do it, and wife's like, no, it's PTS. Don't call it disorder.
I like that.
Some people are worried about calling it a disorder, so they don't, you know, they're going to take my guns away. Or no, it's just, it's not a disorder. It's a natural reaction to an unhealthy event, whether it's your friend sees his buddy slip and fall, or you see a car wreck or a kid get killed, or anything. Firefighters. You know, all first responders, nurses, doctors, they see it every day. You don't get used to it. You don't get used to it. It's not natural. But it's your brain that it develops, PTS develops when you are put into a situation where you feel you can't control it. You can't control the situation. So your brain wants to defend itself. So your sympathetic nervous system starts pumping in cortisol and everything else that, you know, to deal with stress. And then it happens so much that it's a habit. And so now I'm angry, now I'm grumpy, now I think everything's a threat. I perpetuate that every day. Now it's a habit.
Mm-hmm.
Now I just taught myself to stay this way for years.
Mm-hmm.
Versus whenever a thought enters my head or something that's just wrong and I know it's wrong, or I start to act a certain way, to stop, remove myself, go to something totally different that's healthy and happy, and do that for 5 to 30 minutes. And just change those brain patterns. Some guys that don't know, I read a statement, well, yesterday, that when people tell you to get over it, oh, you have PTS, get over it. It's like, okay, basically what they're really saying is, I don't know enough about PTS to help you.
Yeah.
Because you can't get over PTS any quicker than you can get over strep throat, you know?
Yeah.
Just get over your strep throat. It's the same thing. Your brain uses the most energy in your body than anything else. And what do we do? What do we do with PTS? Well, we start drinking. We start eating unhealthy at the bar. We start going out. Everything's unhealthy. Well, your brain gets all that from your gut.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So now your brain, with a healthy food and not as much drinking or drugs, is healthy. You can deal with it. But we perpetuate it by drinking more, by eating poorly. We stop working out. We feel depressed. And now your brain's like, well, everything's a threat. I'm going to defend you by putting up this wall. You know.
So how do you break that pattern? What's the quickest, most efficient way to?
It's not quick. It's not quick. I'm still trying it. Basically, eat healthy, stay active, become part of the tribe again, so you feel relevant and worthy.
Where can somebody get connected to the tribe? Are there different?
Well, there's actually a book called The Tribe out there that a congressman gave me up at in D.C. When we were up there, in November. And the author had given it to him, and he gave it to me. And basically, the tribe is about that mentality of you belong to something and you're productive.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were talking about rite of passages earlier. If you don't, a lot of tribes have a rite of passage to become a man. You have to do something. And now your job in this tribe is to contribute here and there. When you don't feel like you're part of that tribe, you start to feel worthless and you don't belong, and therefore you don't need to exist. Mm-hmm. And then you go down that hill.
Mm-hmm.
Talking is really the only way to get it out. It's like dumping poison out of your body. Like maybe 8 months after I got the text from Jen, we started dating, and I flew here to St. Louis from Savannah. We were at a streetside cafe in town somewhere, and she's like, tell me about Somalia. I was like, wow, it's been 20 years. You just want to know about it, huh? And she's like, well, yeah, I know. One of the guys we work with said you were in Somalia, and I don't know much about it other than when she was growing up as a kid. She remembered standing in her, you know, mom's kitchen, watching it on TV with like just with her hand over her mouth, like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Little did she know that she would meet me and I was there. She wanted to know about it. I started talking about it and just started bawling. Mm-hmm. Just literally started bawling on the street. I'm trying to hide my face. I'm like, stop it. What are you doing? People are looking at me. She's like, that's fine. I'm like, no, it's not. Crying's wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept crying. And then the more I talked about it, the less it bothered me. Even when I first started speaking events and engagements here recently, I would cry on stage trying to get through some things and reliving memories. And the more I talk about it, the easier it gets. And you're letting it go. And I kind of equate it to dumping the poison out. I tell everybody, you know, get over that cultural suicide. The drinking, the chasing women, the living the lifestyle that you think you're supposed to live.
Yeah.
It's just all wrong. It's lack of respect for yourself and other people. Cut down the drinking or stop altogether. I'm not saying stop drinking altogether. That's a whole other world right there for people. Cut down. Eat healthy. Move. Do something to be a part of something else. If you don't, it's your fault. You know, anything in the world you can do, like Tony V, we were talking about, you know, great speakers, and Tony Robbins and Tony V. I think they're actually, I saw a billboard in Denver recently. There's three great speakers. It was Tony Robbins and Tony V and a third one that are going. I was like, that's got to be expensive. But those guys know that just do it.
Yeah.
Just go out and do it. The only limiting factor is yourself.
Yeah.
And we start to limit ourselves. We don't realize it's our brain doing it to us, and we're allowing it.
Well, I think it's a really healing message, too, to let people know that it is okay, that it is, that they're not wrong for feeling those feelings in the first place.
Not, yeah.
But that yes, that there is a point where you can sort of exhale and go, is this really serving me anymore? Is this enriching my life? And finding other people who have gone through that or are still feeling through, like finding that brotherhood and that tribe, I think, you know, this is kind of silly for even me to say, but just in my own experience, in my own ups and downs, there's a radical difference between trying to face it alone. As men, we typically do that.
Right.
Versus seeking out some other brothers in the process. And
it's like asking for directions, you know? just do it. You're going to drive around forever until you do it anyway. Right. So
have some humility. And
yeah.
Well, you know, you talked about the rigidity, and I think, when I think of rigidity, I think of like a dead branch, like mm-hmm. a stick. And how easy is it to break that?
Right.
It doesn't take much to break it. But if you get a live, bendable branch, that's tough as a motherfucker to pull those things off, right? And I think that's a good metaphor for people to think about, because especially as men, especially as military veterans who have dealt with God knows what, but that are in that rigid state where anything outside of that control becomes a threat and they're angry, it's too easy to break.
Right.
Whereas when you learn the flexibility, you learn the vulnerability, you learn the processing of the crying. There was a saying in a personal development program that I went to said, crying is cleansing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the cleaner on your oven. It's just get all that shit out.
Yeah, it really is. The more I cried, the better I felt and the less I started crying.
Yeah.
I mean, I was still to a point where if I watch home improvement shows where they fix people's houses up and at the end they reveal it, and I'm like, oh, it's so nice. It starts to get emotional. I'm like, what am I doing? I literally posted that week ago, and I had a lot of people hit me up. I do too. Give me a call. And I'm like, yeah, I'll call you.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, everybody's going through it, you know?
Well, we're human beings.
Yeah.
We're meant to be emotional, and that's okay. And you're Delta Force and saying it's okay to cry. I mean, who else would be a better spokesperson to say that this is part of life? And it's okay. I think that's an important message. So we are getting a little bit short on time. I know you need to get going here. Tell the listeners a little bit about your foundation that you and Jen started and how people can help support that.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got two things going now. All Secure Foundation is our nonprofit. We filed our paperwork. We're waiting getting back our 501c3. It should be pretty quick since it's for veterans. They say they push them through quicker. Then we'll be able to take donations. We've got a lot of, and that's allsecurefoundation.org, and it's on Facebook as well. But a lot of people lined up to donate. People are donating land, houses, their services, money as well. I'm obviously not taking money yet because it's not a tax write-off yet.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a resource library to help veterans find help, because when you're sick and you need help, and your wife needs help too. Your family needs help too. So when Jen was trying to find me help, it was so difficult to find the right doctors or doctors that take TRICARE, or where do I go? Who understands this? Especially here in St. Louis, where it's not a big military presence. TRICARE is a little bit hard to find, which is what I have coverage, you know. And then I went to a couple and they just didn't have it. They just didn't really understand where I was coming from. And I don't really know why, but we've teamed up with a lot of other organizations like Where's Heart or Station Foundation or Reboot Colorado all throughout the nation to where, okay, what's your problem? They'll call us up. What's your issue? What's going on? And they're always the same anyway. They're literally always the same. The family issues. I mistreat my kids, my wife. I'm angry. I hurt. I'm out of shape. Okay, let's get going. We'll place them in where they need to go.
Okay.
That way they don't have to do the work. And then only after you get help, you're doing better, and you turn, in turn, come back and help us help other people.
Yeah.
Then we look at giving you like a vacation for it. Like, instead of just bringing you in and go fishing or hunting or shooting or whatever, or send you and your family to Disney, which is probably the worst thing to do with a guy with PTSD, send them to Disney, is to get them help first and then give them something. Because if not, it's just a vacation and you come back home and now you still have the problems to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, I sent a friend of mine, I got him a $70,000 grant to go to Warrior's Heart, a big addiction place. He had more addictions than I knew about. Illicit, heavy drugs. And I worked with him for years and didn't know it. Alcohol, everything. And he had just reached bottom. Got him some funding from a local company here, actually Kolb Grading. Jeff Kolb footed that bill with his foundation. Sent him to Warrior's Heart for, I think, 12 weeks. Got him detoxed, cleaned up, got him a whole new set of teeth. I mean, he has been nothing but a pit bull in helping people get better now, and he's stuck with it. That's a lot of people go into relapse. He hasn't, and he stays with it, and he helps other people, and I think that's the difference. I call him up, put him on a mission, and he's on it. He'll get somebody where he needs to go as well.
Yeah, I think that's a real light of hope for a lot of people that have PTS, is that it might feel crushing, but if you can just have a glimpse of how you can rise up and learn to cope and learn to live with that and eventually be free from it, that you can turn around and help somebody else.
Absolutely.
I mean, what greater purpose could there be to help lift somebody out of that?
It's like AA. If you go to AA, you're there for life.
Yeah.
You have to do it every day, every week, whatever they do. Some people have to do it every day. Yeah. Some people stop going and they're okay. But you have to do what you need. You know, and then we've recently started All Secure Mission, to where it's a for-profit, but it's very low, and it's online courses for reintegration to the family, or, you know, PTS.
Like,
or
video courses and stuff?
Video and, oh, cool. And documents. You can download it. Getting fit, getting healthy, diets, things like that. We have psychologists and people contributing to help with papers, so you can save between $59 and $200, whatever course it is, and then you come in, you take the course. You can download it. I don't care if you share it. We don't care, you know. Other people are like, well, don't do something so they can't share it. You're going to lose money. I'm like, it's not really about that.
Yeah.
You know, I have to offset some costs here, but it's to get cost-effective ways to help people. They can take it on the road with them. They can deploy with it. They can share it with their friends. We don't care.
Yeah.
But we just want to help people. We make other money doing other things, you know, writing a book, doing speak engagements, and plus I have a job. So, you know, just staying busy, but we just want to help. And we want to recruit more people along the way to help us help other people.
What can the average person do to help? So they can donate, obviously. But are there opportunities to talk with people to help talk through things?
I mean, is that absolutely? I've got friends from different states and people I don't even know that are interested. Say, I want to open up a chapter here. I'm like, okay, well, we have to vet you first to make sure that everything's good to go, and then make sure you're preaching the same mission, because I've seen some organizations make money selling t-shirts with booze on them and guns and girls. It's like, okay, you're still pushing the same culture.
Yeah.
I want to get away from that. I want to get away to healthier, happier kind of things. If I sell a shirt, it's going to be something different. Not a shirt with skulls and crossbones on it, you know, which the military likes because it looks cool. But you're still staying in the same culture, you know. I've told a couple companies, like, no, I don't like the message you're sending. Mm-hmm. I don't like the misogynistic/cultural message that you're sending. We want to go down a different path of respect and healthy, happy people. And I know it's weird to say it for you killers out there that think that being a man means, you know, I can go kill, I can go on a mission, and I don't have emotions. That's not what a man is, you know. You'd asked me earlier, or you talk about what's it like to be, what's your definition of a man? It's probably the toughest question with the easiest answer. You're born a man. Mm. You did nothing to become a man. That's science. I'm more down the path of, what does it take to be a good person?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
respect, understanding, listening, giving in. All right. Well, I'm not always right. I'm never always right, ever. I'm quite wrong a lot of times. I will spit some things out that sound good, and somebody will tell me something different. I'm like, okay, you're right. You're right. I'm wrong.
I feel like that's Jen coming through a little bit.
Yeah, I have. I've learned to have no problem with being wrong because everybody's wrong. I tell people in the rooms, like, raise your hand if you've never failed before. Because my message is the greatest failure is a failure to try. Raise your hand if you've never failed, because that is what you need to do in life to get better. You have to fail.
Mm-hmm.
You learn how to fix it and you keep going. Greatest failure is failure to try, and you never quit. And you can be anything you work hard at. You know, growing up, your parents, you can be anything you want to be. Like, they didn't tell you the difficult part. Yeah. You have to work at it.
Yes.
You can't just grow up and be something. Yeah. You know, I want to be an astronaut. That's great. Yeah. Okay, there's a lot of work to do that before you can become an astronaut. So you have to work at it. People can hit us up online or on Facebook or find me on Facebook, if not All Secure Mission or All Secure Foundation. Hit us up and tell us your ideas, because I can't be everywhere. I'm going to start bringing in other people to help speak, open up other places, because it's a close-knit community that the veterans have that they all say they miss,
mm-hmm.
talking to someone who understands them. I'm like, everybody would understand you if you didn't tell the story. Like, there I was shooting this guy in the face and stabbing people and blood everywhere. Of course, people are like, whoa, you know. Yeah. You don't need to glorify it, because there's nothing glorious about war. It's horrible. All the loss and the families that are affected that live over there. All the innocent families that have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. They 10, 20 years after that fact of, you know, I don't know how long it took to build up Germany, 22, 3, 24 years mm-hmm. to even start getting construction back up. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, think of these other countries that aren't as squared away as Germany was back in the day. Yeah. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Somalia.
They're still, you know, a crappy place to be. I mean, maybe they just got a government, maybe,
mm-hmm.
just recently.
Yeah. Well, we are just about out of time, so I just wanted to, you know, one of the things that came to me as I was watching your videos online in preparation for this was that you're really still in service. It's not thank you for your service as if it's done. You're still in service. And I don't mean just the All Secure Foundation. I mean still dealing with the PTS stuff, still working through that, still. And obviously, you know, you've gotten to that point where you're now reaching out and helping others. But I say that to anybody that's listening who may be just dealing with PTSD themselves, is thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you for going through all of that shit to give us the opportunity to live our lives the way we want to live them. I mean, it's I try not to take that for granted, but it's a true blessing to be able to live in this country and to have people like yourself and all your brothers that have given their lives for it. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah,
I think veterans need to know that. I hear them, I see, I read it a lot. You know, I did this for you. I did this so you can live free. Well, you also live here.
Mm-hmm.
As a veteran, you also live here. You did it for yourself as well. You
mm-hmm.
know it. People yell, hero. I'm like, nope, servant. I'm not a hero. You know, I did my job. I did what I had to do. I was trained well, so that training took over. It's horrible for anybody to go through. But you have to move on. Mm-hmm. You have to push past all the bad, and mm-hmm. you have to want it. You know, you can't sit back and just live in the glory days of, I threw the high school pass. Man, I was the man. You know, people are like, what do? I don't start with, I'm a retired Delta Force Star Major. It's like, oh, what do? I work at Asymmetric Solutions. I'm working on a book. I'm trying to help veterans. What did I do to get here? Okay, that's my past.
Mm-hmm.
Need to move into the future and the present, you know. And you can't do that stepping sideways or backwards. You have to move forward. So,
absolutely. Well, thanks again, Tom. And it's been an honor to chat with you here for a little bit. And I, again, so appreciate your, given your experience, your ability to shed a lot of the heaviness and the poison, as you mentioned, and give people a light of hope. So,
awesome. Yeah, I appreciate you having me here.
Excellent.
Loved it.
Thanks again, man.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Wired for Impact with Tom Satterlee. I hope listening to this conversation gave you a better understanding and more respect for the type of sacrifices that our service members go through in order to protect us. The amount of trauma that they experience in battle, but then obviously also at home afterwards is unparalleled to the average day for the average American. And the least that we can do is support them in getting healing and comfort while after coming home from warfare. If you'd like to support Tom and Jen's nonprofit, you can do so by going to allsecurefoundation.org. Again, that's allsecurefoundation.org. It's the organization that they started that helps special operations warriors and their families heal from the trauma of war. Again, it's a nonprofit, and you can get in contact with Tom and his team there. So please reach out to allsecurefoundation.org and make a donation today. Thank you again for listening to this episode. I've got some other great episodes coming your way soon. Until then, this is Peter King signing off.